that local communities within themselves have a development of their local character as Sami communities. And those two developments of the organizational aspect in the wider sense, leading hopefully to the election of a Sami parliament, and the process that's taking place within the local communities, somehow can be merged in the future. They are not merged yet, but the direction of development point that they are coming closer to each other. And well, when I am speaking about this, I want to point to a particular problem that we encounter very often in the Nordic countries. It's said to us as Samis from the majority population that in which way can you hope to achieve anything when you do not agree among yourselves on all points? And first, one doesn't know what to answer to that. But the obvious answer is that every society in this modern world functions in the way that people obviously do not agree. But that's part of the democratic process, that there are disagreements, but there are also developments of consensus, and one is able to perceive in which direction the consensus can lead and is permitted to lead. So what we are stressing when trying to point out the need for a democratic elected superimposed organ like the Sami parliament is the fact that only on the condition that also disagreements can be played out in an elected body can it be said to represent the whole people as such. And that's what's one of the points of having an elected body. I don't know how much this answered or what you started to ask.
I think it answered it somewhat, but
yeah.
Well, I think Charlie Edwardson, you have a question.
In a case called Denmark was challenged of its sovereignty for Greenland by Norway, and in a boundary dispute between Denmark and Norway, a criteria of sovereignty was developed when the claim of Norway had asserted claim that it had lost people that had went to secure this place called Greenland were defeated in battle and had lost. The World Court had found that the Norwegian government could not secure sovereignty. So when you take a look at the survival of the Sami rights and a paradigm of the Kalaallit, rights of the Kalaallit, who were successful in repelling this foreign invader called Norway, and in 1931 the World Court gave award to Denmark, not because Denmark had conquered the Kalaallit, but the Kalaallit had chosen to be favorable to the Kingdom of Denmark. And so the definition that they had developed for extinguishing sovereignty, that the acts of discovery by Norway in the space where they had lost in defeat, they could not lay a claim to sovereignty. So if they cannot lay a claim to sovereignty that the Samis possessed, what have you done in the utility of this case against Norway, where a local group like the Kalaalleq had maintained their territory. And so in the North Americas, the displacement of the indigenous population has been done with a penal attitude. The development of property law, or lack of it, in, see, America, Canada, Australia, New Zealand are a victim of a greater circumstance which occurred, and there were penal colonies. So the social idea, the human development of the community of dealing with native people comes in a colonial, in a penal form. So this development that occurred in America, then a miracle happened that the American Anglo-Saxon people got tired of that and created a rebellion because it was unhuman to receive this kind of treatment. So some Indians sided with the with their local guest, and came it was the development of Treaty of Paris. And the historical context was the Indians were on both sides of the war, that the local community had a split. So in North America, we have on the American side a constitutional forum. On the British side, we have colonial charters. So Canada is on its verge of its own discovery, for the simple fact that they have been thinking since 1867 that a colonial charter is a constitution, when England itself have no constitution. So the Canadian context in thinking that they have a constitution with a colonial charter is a little bit farce for us to think that the Canadians have a constitution when they are in a process of getting one. And so where America was at the time of the revolution is where Canada is today with its constitution. It is, there are a year old into a constitutional administration. And if the people of Canada should choose to elect what the basis of discrimination and what rights are going to be, then we can successfully take a look at our treatment. The American treatment has not been favorable. It's just that the TV media has gotten up, that the technology is as such where inequalities can be measured by larger, greater population because of decentralized press, not probably because that there's a constitution. And it is in the same liking that that Norway cannot go up to the Sami land and say, who are these? So there is a rule of prescription where the colonial powers have lost, in this case, where the Kalaalleq, the local population, was not displaced. But the world, instead of the world court awarding the jurisdiction to the Kalaalleqs, they awarded to the Denmark, who was the guest, who was the host. And this lesson, I guess, can be paralleled by the sale of Long Island, Manhattan, and that sovereignty that the Samis have and the sovereignty that the Inupiats have and the Inuvialuit have is real. It has not been displaced. We are not displaced from our lands. We have them. And what has happened in the case of Alaska is we decide the American Justice Administration of Justice decided to change things. They decided to change the rules. And in so coming here, that we have a hodgepodge of administration, but what is equally persistent is they will settle with you as soon as you go to debt. And they will give you an offer. I went through all of the Alaska Native land claims. The question is, because you have not been displaced, what is the legal position of Norway? Because they cannot officially displace you. You are still in existence. You have a language. You have a home. And how do they expect to displace you without your permission?
Well, Alf Isaac, there's a lot wrapped up in that question. Do you want to address anything that Charlie Edwardson said, or since Greenland is sitting next to you, maybe we should, after you've spoken, see if Robert Peterson wants to speak to that matter.
Well, the fact is that the Sami population can be displaced, not by being moved away, but by being overrun, in a sense.
Overrun.
Yes. For by demographic developments, in the sense that if, for instance, there are huge industrial developments, for instance, in the core area, it's easy to imagine how mass immigration from outside could extinguish the cultural character of the core area. And of course that has already happened somewhere. For instance, in the easternmost community of the northern province, the South Varanger, there is a huge iron mine and steel processing plant, which has led to that the fact that in a period of perhaps 50 years, what was originally a Sami majority area is now an area where the Samis constitute only 10% of the population. And that is why we feel it's very important to have the ability to think forward in terms of, as it's said here, such areas are to be established by an official list. And that can be interpreted into several directions, of course. Before I turn the microphone to Robert, I would like to say that the Sami land is not an island, and that makes it particularly vulnerable. Thank you.
Before we move on to Robert Peterson, might I just see if we can maybe make the foolhardy attempt to put in capsule form this whole issue of sovereignty, and then I'll call on Robert Peterson. And after that, I should say that I consulted with some of the Canadian representatives about the order in which we should call on them, and we agreed, more or less, that we should start with Mark Gordon to talk about the James Bay and Northern Quebec settlement, and then Dwight Nosworthy representing the territorial government and its chief negotiator with COPE, you could talk about the Mackenzie Delta settlement with the Inuvialuit. And then the CYI, the Council of Yukon Indians, Mike Smith and Glenn Grady, maybe you would tell us about the settlement recently concluded with the Yukon Indians and the Government of Canada. Then we'll move on to Dennis Patterson and Peter Atinwar, who can tell us about the proposals for new jurisdictions in the Canadian North, Nunavut and Denende, one Inuit, the other Dene. And then we will hear from Randy Ames about the Inuit Tapirisat land claim, and then from Steve Kakwi, Bill Erasmus, and Rick Hardy about the claims of the Dene and the Métis. And Rick might also add something about the whole question of status and non-status Indians in the Northwest Territories. Rosita Worrell, who works with our commission, feels that there may be some analogy in that to the growing division in Alaska between Native persons who hold shares in the corporations and those born since 1971 who do not. So I think we'll proceed in that way. Might I just, before calling on Robert Peterson to speak for about Greenland, and I don't want to detain us longer, but Charlie Edwardson has been saying, and others have said, from the beginning of this overview, how can they say that they achieved sovereignty over an Aboriginal population? And Doug Slanders said yesterday there was no adequate theory for European sovereignty over new lands inhabited by Aboriginal populations anywhere in the world. And it was said last week that Chief Justice John Marshall simply looked at it in that way and said, well, the government of the United States has taken over and we're not going to interfere. Now, let me just leave you with this question, and we may return to it at the end of the afternoon. Suppose the government of the USA and the government of the Soviet Union, just to take the two most powerful governments in the world, were to discover in some planet that they might reach in 10 years a population of people with their own language, their own religion, their own way of life. By what theory of international law, assuming we extended it to the planets and the stars, by what theory would either of those governments, or both of them acting jointly, be entitled to convert them to Christianity or to communism or to the free enterprise system or to some collectivist arrangement? By what theory of international law would they be entitled to assume that that land came under the sovereignty of a European power? By what theory would they be entitled to subjugate those people and take their land? Now, we really can't get into that now, or we'll be here for the next 3 days on it. Think about that, and if you will allow me to do so, we could perhaps turn to it later. I think now, though, we should ask Robert Peterson to tell us about the Home Rule movement in Greenland and about the state of land claims in Greenland. Mr. Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I suppose I have to mention some historical preconditions for Greenland Home Rule. Greenland was Danish colony for many years, and this situation began with Norse Vikings from Iceland who settled in southernmost part of Greenland 1,000 years ago, agreed with the Norwegian king that they would pay tax for him, and a couple of 100 years later, the Norway and Denmark got the same king. And after, for some reason, when Norway was separated from Denmark in 1814, the Atlantic Islands, Iceland, Faroe Islands, and Greenland remained within the Danish realm. This situation as colony, it continued till 1953, when Denmark got a new constitution, and in which Greenland was recognized as formal part, integral part of Denmark. As mentioned by Alf Isaac, it was the great difference between Sameland and Greenland, that Greenland is situated beyond an ocean from Denmark, quite separated, and this separation was always recognized. When Denmark recolonized Greenland in 1720s, it was partly with hope that Denmark could participate in European whaling in East Greenland and especially Davis Strait, but it was not successful. And in this connection, Denmark began to buy blubber from Greenlandic hunting, and in this way also was interested in keeping a traditional way of living in Greenland for many years. In 1920s, the Greenlandic waters became warmer, and while seals disappeared partly from southern West Greenland, shoals of codfish came and make it possible to small-scale fishing from small vessels in West Greenland. And it was in this way rather easy transfer from sealing to fishing, because the household organization could be kept intact, in fact, till the industrialization of Greenland began after 1950. Even if Greenland is called Greenland to tempt Icelandic farmers, it couldn't tempt other European farmers to itself, and in this way the soil of Greenland was regarded as useless, and there was very little temptation to take land in Greenland. In this way, Greenlandic economy was based on subsistence hunting and fishing, in fact, till this century. In the beginning of this century, sheep farming was also started in southern part of Greenland, but it was also regarded as a supplement for household economy. Supplement for household economy
in
West Greenland, and this way it had also no great effects on Greenlandic way of living. And when this was introduced, there were made royal it was not real act, but regulation that decided that the sheep farmers should not be private owners of their land, but should have right to use it. I think it was for 99 years. In this way, the Greenlandic land was never owned by individuals. And I think that it is one of the things that made the Greenlandic development different from other developments in Europe and especially North America and Oceania and Australia. In this connection,
excuse me, Mr. Peterson, I'm awfully sorry. What was it that distinguished Greenland from North America and Australia?
It was that there has been no private ownership on land.
Oh, I see. Even by the Danes who came to Greenland, they didn't have any private ownership of land.
No.
I see, yeah.
And land and subsurface was regarded as crown land and became regarded as owned by the state. There was a commission on mineral resources in Greenland in the 1950s and it had a report in 1960 and stated that both land and mineral resources in Greenland were owned by the state, of course the Danish state. And this was in fact regarded as a true dogma till about 1970. In this period, we learned native movements both in Alaska and Canada and Norway, and began to question if the state sovereignty automatically could be interpreted as land ownership. In fact, we didn't. It was at the Institute of Eskimology, University of Copenhagen. We put these questions, and in fact, it came in a good period. In the end of the 60s, the debate of controversial climate of debate on controversial questions was getting better in the world, I think, and ideas that could be regarded as annoying were discussed seriously, and this question became also one of the ideas that were developed in Greenland. In the same period, there has been a European economic community that began to negotiate about including some more European states. Among them was Denmark. In 1972, there was referendum both in Denmark and Greenland and Faroe Islands. Faroe Islands had, at least at this time, a home rule government and had in this way formal possibility to vote separately from Denmark. While Greenland was formerly integral part of Denmark, and in this way had to vote together with Denmark. In Greenland, 70% of given votes were against joining European Economic Community, but disappeared in the Danish yes. And in this way, Greenland became member of European Economic Community against its want. Most of the important factors in this connection, I think that Greenland had still today consciousness of wish to keep the animal stocks so intact as possible, and EEC, European Economic Community, has a new policy towards fishing and hunting, Greenlandic, and I think also together with Greenland, also Norway, that also had said no thanks for European Economic Community at this time, and Faroe Islands, they were against membership in a community which had no fishing policy, and today the fishing policy is a very difficult question within EEC. I think this membership of EEC has been one of the important factors when three young politicians, namely Jørgen Motzfeldt, Lars Emil Johansen, and Moses Olsen, began to cooperate about their politics. This developed to, in some years, to establishment of Siumut Party, that is a governing party in Greenland today. And the same year, Jørgen Motzfeldt proposed that consideration towards home rule in Greenland should be begun. The following year, there was established a home rule committee consisting of five Greenlandic politicians and with no Danish member. They came with their report in 1975, and in connection with the Faroe Islandic home rule, we proposed that some responsibilities in legislation and administration should be transferred from Danish Parliament and ministries to Greenland. And in this connection, also the budget should be transferred to Greenland. In the beginning, the idea was that the Greenlandic home rule should be financed from Greenland resources, but in the following body, Home Rule Commission, that had both Greenlandic and Danish politicians as members and had a Danish chairman, they proposed that Greenland Home Rule should be financed partly by taxation Greenland, partly by subsidies in Greenland from Denmark. And it proposed that question on foreign affairs, health service, order, police, and question of sovereignty and inspection of coastal seas should be in Danish hands. Of course, also question of defense, while economic development, game management, culture and education, social matters, and housing, like question, should be transferred to home rule government. Home rule was introduced in 1979, and much of these decisions and thoughts were introduced today. In connection with economic and resource question, the renewable resources are under responsibility of home rule government, while non-renewable resources are on shared responsibility. There is a body consisting of Danish and Greenlandic politicians that decide question of mining, mineral resources, life thing. And in this connection, they are also some kind of consensus of sharing possible revenue from mining, and it says that the first part of income should be to cover Greenlandic expenses and what maybe the rest should be shared by Denmark and Greenland according to an agreement. This agreement is not formulated today. Under the negotiations of a Home Rule Commission, one of the Greenlandic members, Lars Emil Johansen, struggled very much to get Greenlandic land claim recognized, ownership by the Greenlandic community of land in Greenland. But for some reason, some of the Greenlandic members, those who later on became members of Atassut, wouldn't support him in this question. And as there was a strong opposition of some of the Danish politicians, they couldn't agree about land ownership, Greenlandic land ownership in Greenland. And at last, when the negotiations were being destroyed, they got an agreement that says that Greenlandic people have fundamental rights in Greenland, and today has nobody tried to define what this means. I think that there are different thoughts about it both in Greenland and Denmark. But for in some way, Greenlandic people have fundamental rights and don't know how they can do this agreement. And I can finally mention that after introduction of home rule, we realized that Greenland Inuit, which we used to regard as a minority towards Denmark, are people with own minorities and majorities. And it is very interesting consideration. After introduction of home rule, it was possible on formal basis to have a new referendum in connection with membership of EEC and EEC, and it was taken last year with a majority who wanted to leave European Economic Community. After this, there has been different and rather difficult negotiations, because especially because Germany wanted fishing rights in Greenland. And they were very against losing this right, while there was a rather calm attitude towards this question among the other members of EEC. And after long negotiations, it was agreed that Greenland could leave EEC from January 1985, and within the agreement there were sharing of a total allowed catch of fish of 83,000 tons, and of this should 59,000 tons be caught by Greenlandic fishermen, while the rest should be allowed to be caught by others, among others, Danes and Germans. But for this right, EEC should pay some compensation, and in this way, Greenlandic economy should have roughly the same level, Greenlandic budget have roughly the same level as earlier. Greenland had received EEC economic foundation for developing regions, and it was about 6% of Greenlandic yearly budget, about 2 billion Danish crowns. This 6%, and this support from EEC was especially used for infrastructural plants in Greenland, ports, airports, ways, and like things. And they were lost now in this way, but in connection with we told from ESE they were sold some quarters that in this way were in this way it could replace the lost amount, and Greenlandic development planning could so continue almost in the same speed as earlier. It was in this connection that there came problems in home rule government. We have three parties. Siumut was mentioned, that is governing party, and it could govern with in coalition with the least party in the Greenlandic Home Rule Parliament, Inuit Ataqatigiit, who in this way was against allowing ESE quotas in Greenlandic waters, and together with Atashut had passed a new confidence vote last Friday. But before this, Atashut voted together with Siumut and passed the agreement with ESE that Greenland could leave ESE from 1985 and get a new state, overseas land and territories state towards ESE, and it means that Greenland could export fish and other products to ESE without